Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about episode 2 of New Scientist, May the 4th. Is it May the 4th be with you, or whatever it is? Okay. Taking on the tech giants. Companies like Facebook and Google have become to dominate our lives. It's time to cut them down to size. Is it time to cut them down to size, Douglas Heaven? As campaign vision goes, it's one of the most people can get behind. US 2020 presidential hopeful Elizabeth Warren wants tech companies to play by the rules. You don't get to be an umpire and have a team in the games, the Democrat candidate told an audience last week, describing how she believes Amazon exploits the market position to smother competitors. But the way she wants to achieve this could prove decisive. My administration will take big structural changes into the tech sector to promote more competition, including breaking up Amazon, Facebook and Google, she said in a campaign statement earlier this year. Warren is far from the first to make this call. Over the past few years, companies on her hit list have been accused of perverting democracy, amplifying hate crimes and stifling rivals. How big do these companies have to be before they're considered too dominant, says Martin Moore at King's College London. Quote, when you have more than a quarter of the world's population on your platform, that qualifies in any book. Still, most public figures taking on these juggernauts, chief amongst them Margaret Vestager, a European Commissioner for Competition, have stopped short of a breakup. Instead, we have seen new rules such as EU's general data protection regulations and large fines. For example, Google has hit with a string of whopping fines for abusing market dominance in the EU, including a 2.4 euro billion in 2017 and 4.3 billion in 2018, the largest fine ever, and a 15 billion in March. But set against the annual revenue of Google's parent company, Alphabet, more than 136 billion in 2018, they just look like the cost of doing business. Quote, I don't want to call them parking tickets, but these are small fines in companies that make so much a year, said Christina Kaffer, head of the European competition practice consulting firm Rivet Charles River Associates. So if the fines aren't working, is Warren's right to call for a breakup? It's been done before. In the 1990s, the US government charged Microsoft with gaining an unfair advantage by including its web browser, Internet Explorer, on computers running its running the marketing Windows operating system. Microsoft was seen as preventing other companies' browsers getting a look in. Microsoft was told it couldn't bundle a separate software products together and forced it to open up Windows so other software developers could write programs on it more easily. By splitting off a piece of software like a browser is easier than carving up like Amazon, Facebook and Google. Warren suggests separating the running of a platform from doing business on the platform. For example, Amazon runs a marketplace which sells its low-cut price products, making it harder for others to compete. Benedict Evans, an analyst at the venture capitalist firm Anderson Howitz in San Francisco, has described Warren's proposal as an odd combination of both very specific and very vague. Evan asks if this thinking applies to things like Apple's App Store. Should Apple be allowed to sell its own apps? What would supermarkets like Walmart and Sainsbury have been selling their own brand products at lower prices for decades? Isn't Amazon just doing the same? You could argue Amazon's unprecedented dominance of online shopping makes things different. For Kafra, it's if Walmart or Sainsbury's had first bought most of their retailers before cutting prices, which wouldn't be allowed in the bricks and mortar world. Say you do want to break these firms up, then the best way might be to undo mergers, some of which would probably never have been allowed, said Kaffer. Google dominates online advertising largely because it bought a string of businesses like DoubleClick. These are integrated into Google's business, and cutting them out would damage the whole, but it wouldn't be impossible, says Moore. Facebook similarly grew to dominate social media by vacuuming up rivals such as Instagram and WhatsApp, both of which have helped gain a foothold in most of the world's phones. But again, it would be hard now to disentangle the apps from Facebook's core business, which is collecting much data on people as possible. The company seems to be trying to bolster its defences against the breakup. CEO Mark Zuckerberg recently announced it would be merging the code and the data of Instagram and WhatsApp more tightly with the core Facebook app. Even if you could see a way to do it, breaking up a large company is no quick fix for regulators. It's a last-ditch option, more a threat than a viable response. The European Commission-driven divestiture has been tougher than most on big tech. But legally, to consider such far-reaching courses of action would require to demonstrate that breakup was the only way to rein in companies' bad conduct, which could not be straightforward. For these reasons, the better option may be to double down on regulation. CAFRA says calls to break up tech are more common in the US, where the tech firms have been left to do more or less what they want since the Microsoft case 20 years ago. There is a sense of frustration in many of these quarters. Nothing else is being done, and nothing short of breaking up will work, as she says. That may be starting to change. Last week, Facebook warned investors that it expected to be fined as much as $5 billion by the US Federal Trade Commission, which is currently investigating the firm's result of the Cambridge Analytica data scandal. Diane Coyle of University of Cambridge, who co-authored the independent review of digital competition for the UK government, says regulators could use existing powers more. For example, UK, Facebook and YouTube could be treated as publishers and held responsible for the content. They'd have to do a lot to comply, says Coyle. The report argues for a new regulations like making it easier for new businesses to use established platforms so that they aren't shut out of the market, allowing users to transfer data from one platform to another. In fairness, Facebook, Google, Microsoft and Twitter are part of an initiative called Data Transfer Project, which works towards this aim. But if you want services like this, like search or social networks, to become more like this, more like email, with different products such as Gmail, Outlook, all using the same underlying protocol, then there's a long way to go. Coyle also says regulators need to think differently about acquisitions, treating Instagram as just a photo sharing platform and not a Facebook competitor was naive, she says. Regulations is inevitable, says Moore, but we have to be careful how we do it. He thinks we should need a clear sense of the kind of relationship society should have with big tech before we jump in. Choosing the kind of services we want the likes of Amazon, Facebook and Google to provide will determine how we shape the behaviour of companies throughout regulation. For example, if we think as Warren does, these tech companies should be more like utilities when a search engine provider might become a highly regulated as water and electricity firms. Or if we are most about privacy, what happens to our data? Then we need specific regulations to enforce transparency and interoperability. Once we ask these questions, we may find ourselves re-examining the economic role behind these firms. Some say the billions made by Facebook and Google are a result of surveillance capitalism, in which services are provided in exchange for personal data. For more, dealing with the economic model is a bigger problem. If you don't, then you're going to get other companies just as dominant in the future, he says. Okay, working hypothesis. Sorting the week's supernova from sub-absolute zeros. Okay. Slow walkers. The UK Ordnance Survey is to recalculate how long walking routes take. Its Victorian-era formula currently generates times that are unrealistically fast for many hikers. Patient physicists. The radioactive decay of xenon-124 has been observed, with a half-life of a trillion times the age of the universe. It makes watching paint dry an extreme sport. So it's xenon-124. Oh, that's a thing, but I think it's bismuth. It's radioactive. In Donald Trump, in other rare news, the US president has come out in favour of science. He declared vaccinations are so important in response to the US measles outbreak. Russian whale. A whale wearing a harness marked equipment of St. Petersburg may have been trained by the Russian Navy, or perhaps is just like visiting cathedrals Asteroid Ryukyu. Japan confirmed that it had blasted a hole in an asteroid Ryukyu and is going a small way to avenge the dinosaurs. Isn't that nice how they're doing that? Ten minutes in, my god, it's feeling bad. Greenland can't go green. The Arctic's melting fast. The world needs to wake up to just how fast and what the impacts will be. It's not exactly a natural icebreaker, but the Earth scientists are talking a lot about ice right now. I met quite a few of them in the European Geoscientists Union Assembly in Vienna, Austria. One particular eye-opening moment came when Harry Zelokia of Delta University Technologies in the Netherlands showed me his computer models indicating that half of the alpine glaciers are doomed by mid-century. Whatever action now we take to curb carbon emissions. If anything, the model seems to a conservative representation of the facts on the ground. A few days later, NASA was highlighting the satellite imaging of the Arctic glaciers slipping at the rate that was simply nuts, according to one researcher involved, 20 metres a day, compared with 20 metres a year in 2013. We have recently learned how increasing rainfall in Greenland is melting more ice than when anyone expected. If Greenland starts to green, we have a real problem. The ice cap there is 3 kilometres deep and contains enough water to raise sea levels by several metres. It's looking increasingly vulnerable. A study just out by PNAS has just looked almost half a century of data to conclude that Greenland's annual ice mass loss has grown nearly sixfold in 30 years. This year's melt season has already begun a month early. So much bad news begins to wash over you. That's exactly what researchers worry. Eric Rignock, the author of PNAS paper, says that the surprises to him is how much science people need before contemplating action. If alpine glaciers disappear, that's a blow to the region's tourism and hydroelectric industries. Perhaps we can tolerate a loss of skiing holidays. Perhaps you should anyway. Greenland is a different league. An unfolding environmental problem with incalculable global economic risks attached. It is still not too late to act. Debate on ongoing when we will reach the climate tipping points where feedback processes kick in to accelerate melting, potentially wiping out Greenland's ice sheet. But the dynamics of ice melting means melting doesn't increase linearly with the world warms. We know there are significant Greenland ice sheets 130,000 years ago when summer temperatures were several degrees warmer. So every fraction of degree warming avoided helps avert the worst. Some researchers are already reviving talks of geoengineering our way out from catastrophe. Injecting cool sulfates into the atmosphere could reduce Greenland's ice loss by 10% by 2070, according to the modelling of the team at Beijing Normal University, also presented in Vienna. But even, they love pollution, don't they, the Chinese? But even if that is technically feasible, the uncertain global impacts make the politically a no-go. Countries in a recent UN meeting even rejected a proposal for a simple assessment of the climate cooling technologies. The answer isn't sexy, deep, rapid cuts in fossil fuels, fuel use. This week past, I've been talking to instigators of the Extinction Rebellion movement, see page 12. The detail and demands might be unrealistic, but they have created a resonance. The climate certainly has tipping points. Can societies have them too? I rather like that. So, that's a science. I like how you get one concept and get the bare bones of the concept and apply it into different places. Okay. Annalie is a science journalist and author. Her novel Autonomous won the Lambda Literary Award, and she is co-host of the Hugo-nominated podcast, Our Opinions Are Correct. You can follow her, Aileen, at her website, at Aileen. Not-so-smart cities. Internet-linked devices can improve our lives, but all the related data gathering gives the risk of a new kind of street crime, as writes Annalie Newitz. Because I live in San Francisco, I've been subject to a number of ill-fated experiments performed by short-lived tech companies. The most recent involves app-controlled electronic scooters. With a little advance notice, a handful of companies blanketed the San Francisco with a lavish branded e-scooters. Anyone with the right app could ride on one and then park it somewhere properly. Unfortunately, proper parking is really in the eyes of the beholder. Scooters wound up blocking sidewalks, streets, gutters, doorways. City workers routinely had to drift them out of a large local lake. One company, Lime, posted pictures of its broken waterlogged scooters on Twitter. San Francisco complained at great length, and the city banned them for several months. And yet, so far, the experiment continues. Two new e-scooter companies have recently signed a deal with San Francisco government, promising to do it right this time. Debris from trashed e-scooters is one unexpected side effect from the idea marketers' futurist called a smart city. Customers are lit on utopia anchored on eco-friendly power grid saturated by high-speed internet and conveniences like e-scooters on every corner, or autonomous cars that will bring you takeout. I think autonomous cars, really, if you put in autonomous cars and a whole series of innovations, you have to question whether you need an airport. The notion, a good one to be sure, is that we can use software to make our cities more energy efficient for the user. If an office building is empty in the evening, a smart city diverts power from the stadium full to a stadium full of sports fans. If there's a traffic jam somewhere, grab an e-scooter. If there's a storm surge coming, your fully automated home will batten down the hatches for you. All the scenarios depend on people covering our old dumb cities with devices that talk to each other over the internet. Those devices might be weather sensors, gas meters, drawbridge controls, traffic monitors, sanitation systems, surveillance cameras, or e-scooters. They might be stuck on the side of buildings or dangling from drones. The point is that the city becomes a kind of giant computer gathering, crunching data from the real world. The smart city also programmable. I poke a button on my phone and I can summon a car. Likewise, a police officer might be watching CCTV footage of their phone. And a plumber might shut off a water valve with theirs. Scientists could monitor pollution levels from miles away. There's just one problem. If everything is fully or remotely accessible data, then so are you. And that's how a new kind of street crime will emerge. Let's think about e-scooters again. If I use my app to get the scooter, I'm sending a lot of information to the company that rents it to me. There's my credit card, my email, and of course, but more importantly, there's data about where I go. That information is very interesting to thieves with some technical savvy. To get it, the thief injects a malicious code into an ad on the scooter app. When I click the ad, they start tracking me. Multiply that by thousands and the thief can figure out, say, who spends time at a fancy private clubs or government agencies. In a smart city, searching for good mark is easy. Want a rich banker or a bureaucrat with a security clearance? The thief has a list of thousands of potential targets. Now they can send their chosen marks and some phishing emails to gain access to their computer systems at work. It's a tried and true method. A simple phishing scam led to the leak of the Democratic emails during the 2016 election. And that's how my choice of rent an e-scooter might inadvertently help a malicious person break into sensitive computer network. Consider what would happen if someone with technical skills got onto the network that controls bridges and traffic lights, or broke into your house by hacking your app-controlled heating system. When every object in the city is smart, criminals can gain access to your values through digital keyholes you may not even realize are there. That's especially true even you consider the hodgepodge of smart cities are emerging. See, that's because they think of, you know, it's like in feudal times where things are going to have to be protected by walls and things like that. They're just not thinking clearly. So they sort of think that the king will there and he'll put out all the gold and everything out in the field and then be running around. There's this other structure which has to come in. But surfaces like e-scooters, even autonomous cars, will probably be created ad hoc without much regulation. In a smart city of tomorrow, we don't need to need kids not to talk to strangers. We have to teach them not to talk to hoverboards too. I think this is the entire challenge of the tech. Your letters. And there's a set of a cartoon here. It shows earphones and iPads. The participants donned headphones and blindphones. We have served a plate of roast beef, choice beef. One third heard a soundtrack of constant screaming. One third heard a recording from Abadar. And one third heard complete soul. Nobody comes to dinner anymore. Oh dear, that's quite funny. What? Now here's a nice picture. Here's a picture of the page now, so you can remember what it is roughly. What exactly is self-determination then? Robert Casto, Percevin, Moulins, France. My lack of free will gives me no choice but to disagree with Tom Stafford. Isn't that beautiful? Cellular automa may look unpredictable to him, but surely they produce exactly the same pattern when they are started from the same initial conditions, unless a random number generator based on quantum physics is incorporated. And can I say that's exactly what human fingers do? What does he mean by self-determination anyway? I can freely choose between two issues if not outside agents prevented it. If no outside agents prevent it. Then my choice is based on conscious and unconscious preference. If I choose a totally random, can I be called a choice? My illusion of free will comes with the absence of external intervention, but my choices are still determined by my past, which is shaped by what I want. Fortunately, nature is truly random at some level. It would be all totally deterministic and horribly boring without it. Also, Stafford leaving with no choice about his choice engine. This interactive essay on Twitter, a commercial entity based outside our legal space, I have no desire to make an account there. We can expect to see an engine in a non-strings-attached platform. Okay, that's interesting. Stafford is optimistic that we do have free will to make choices. This is a different section. A different person from Bedfordshire, UK. I wonder if our favourite person there is going to be there somewhere. Who's his name? I've got to remember. I think I knew him at Sydney University, someone similar to him. Same name. I can't remember his name. Stafford is optimistic that we do have free will to make choices. I wonder whether he freely chooses to believe that. His genes, prior life experience and career researching the brain all shaped his brain to structure and hold his belief. So it is true, act of free will would be somehow to reject his own optimism of free will. This is rather a paradox. Yeah, this is rather funny. Our genes and experience lead us to generate that is a paradox. It is important, but... In summertime, when the vitamins are easy, I don't know what the article is. Carol Stevenson from London, UK. Linda Gredes reports on the health perils of shunning the sun. This was interesting, but I have a question. How much skin should I expose when I get my daily dose of sunshine? Hands, face are easy, lower arms and legs possible. But is that enough? Editor writes, how much sunshine do you need to get the dose of daily vitamin C? Depends on your skin colour, whether you are at the time. UK's National Health Survey says the UK, you can be your forearms, hands and lower legs in the middle of the day in late March to early September for short periods. But be careful not to burn. Machine learning is not artificial intelligence. I would say that for sure. Three systems misclassified medical images after the pictures were slightly altered. This is systematic of deep misunderstanding. Algorithms like these are not artificial intelligence. No intelligence is involved. They are merely statistical machines, learning algorithms that happen to be based on neural networks. The algorithms don't understand that they are supposed to diagnose cancer. They merely find effective ways to distinguish two categories of images which they are trained. To avoid creating unrealistically high expectation regarding intelligence of such algorithms, it's important to refer them to machine learning algorithms rather than AIs. You should lead the way. I agree with that 100%. Traces of Yamana in modern languages. Corin Barris discusses the fascinating genetic archaeological evidence for the spread of the Yamanya people. I wish I read this one. From the steppes into Europe, Near East. This is the people. He curiously omits the linguistic evidence of the reconstruction of the Proto-Indo-European for modern languages. This suggests the same spread of people over the same time period. It also makes a strong case in support of more cooperation between sciences and humanities. Pierre Alberg from Uppsala, Switzerland. Although Yama left no written work, and circumstantial evidence overwhelmingly points to them to be speakers of the ancestral Indo-European language, which diversified a language family that includes the overwhelming majority of European languages, as well as the Iranian family, Urdu and Hindu. The vocabulary of the proto-Indo-human Indo-European can be reconstructed by comparing words in descendant languages and includes some highly suggestive vocabulary, often given examples. Horse, yoke, and wheel. They hint at mobile people of horse-drawn wagons. So the roots of the descendant language contain the last faint echoes of how the Yermont saw themselves. To thrive, firms must recruit new graduates. Your article in association with SRG reports a shortage of science and engineering skills. It's apparent of a daughter who graduated in the upper second honours degrees in medical engineering last year. I lament the shortage of employers willing to consider recruiting new graduates. Virtually all firms in the UK ask the applicants with specific experience. Perhaps it's time the industry realised that graduates don't come tailor-made for their particular requirements. Rather, they have the aptitudes and abilities to make them work in a variety of situations as given appropriate training. You only have to look online to see my daughter is not alone in this. My message to the industry is, if you want to be a conscientious, hard-working engineer who is willing to move to any part of the country, there is one here. Oh, isn't that beautiful? How indicative votes actually worked. Petros Sedris writes that the majority of MPs prefer some deal between the UK and EU to no deal, and are likely to opt for one of the new options rather than May's proposals, implying that each had a choice, one preferred option from the eight that were on offer. Each MP could vote for any or all the options that they agreed as tolerable. For example, Gareth Thompson, MP for Harrow, voted in favour of five of them in the first round of indicative votes. So that's an important thing to put through. This is really interesting. So that's really, they actually give their correct thing 50 years ago. I don't think I'll write that one. 50 years ago, it's pretty interesting that New Scientist is got a pretty still modern looking thing. There's poor fish being eaten up by Matt. We're 27 minutes in. Nothing in my right hand. You'll need to think about our brains don't lie to us, but magic relies on the fact that they do, says Simon Ings. We need to think. Okay. Exhibition Smokes and Mirrors. According to John Neville Maskelyne, a bad conjurer will make a good medium any day. He means that as a stage musician in the 19th century London, he had to produce successful effects night after night, while rivals who claimed their illusions were powered by spirit world could simply blame it on a bad set of unhelpful spirits or even an audience's own scepticism. A gaffe-ridden performance in the UK by one of a set of spiritualists in the US Davenport brothers drove Maskelyne to invent his own act. With his friend and cabinet maker George Alfred Cook, he created a anti-spiritualistic entertainment at one replicating and debunking the spiritualist movement's stock in trade effects. Matthew Tomlins teases out the historical implications of Maskelyne's story in this spectacle of illusion, magic, the paranoia and the complicity of the mind. Its lavishly illustrated history to accompany Smoke and Mirrors, a new intriguing exhibition in the Wellcome collection in London. The book and exhibition bring a story up to date, for curious truth spiritualism stubbornly refused to die. Historical accident was partly responsible. In 1895, Guglielmo Marconi sent a long radio wave signals over a distance of a couple of kilometres, and for decades after, hardly a year passed, which some researchers didn't announce a new type of visible ray. The world turned out to have aspects of hidden and unaided human perceptions. Was it so unreasonable for people to speculate about what or who might lurk in those hidden corners of reality? were they so gullible, reeling as they were from the mass killings of the First World War, to populate these invisible realms with the dead. In 1924, the magazine Scientific American offered $2,500 to any medium who could demonstrate their powers under scientific controls. The medium, Minnie Marjorie Condon, decided to try her hand, but she reckoned without the efforts of one Harry Handcuff Houdini, who eventually exposed her as a fraud. Oh dear. Yet, spiritualism persisted shading off the into parapsychology, quantum speculation, and any number of cults. Understanding why is more than a purview of a psychologist, Gustav Kuhn, who, as well as being a major contributor to the show, offers insights into magic and magical belief in his own new book, Experiencing the Impossible. Kuhn, a member of the magic circle, finds Maskew's anti-spiritualist form of stage magic alive in the hands of illusionists. Darren Brown. He suggests that Brown is more of a traditional magician than he lets on, dismissing the occult while he endorses a mysterious psychological phenomenon mostly to do with subconscious priming that, at its root, is a non-scientific. Kuhn defines magic as the experience of wonder that results from perceiving an apparently impossible event. Definitions of what is impossible differ, and different illusions work differently in different people. You can even design it for animals as a torrent on YouTube videos based on largely on a Finnish magician's Joseph Baron's magic for dogs test. Tricking dogs is one thing, but why do our minds fall for magic? It was the 18th century Scottish Enlightenment philosopher David Hume who argued that there is no metaphysical glue binding events and that we only infer causal relationships, be they real or illusionary. Twinned with our susceptibility to wrongly infer relationships between events in our world and the ability to fool ourselves at an even deeper level, numerous studies, including one by researcher and former magician Jay Olson and clinician Amy Rizar, which sits at the exit of the Welcome Show, conclude that our feelings of free will may be an essential trick of the mind. Inferring connections makes us confident in ourselves and our abilities, and it is our confidence and necessarily delusion, our brilliance of our cognitive abilities that lets us function and be tricked. Even after reading both books, I defy you to see through the illusions and wonders in store at the exhibitions. That's pretty amazing. Okay, 32 minutes in. Another book, it looks like. Yep, it's so good because they've got a little image of a book here. And what's this here? A book, an exhibition and a book. Oh, it's so cute. I really like this. It's interesting they use things, finding their way from ants to birds. How do animals use their senses to guide them to food, breeding grounds, wonders Michael Bond. Incredible journeys, exploring the wonders of animal navigation by David Murray Holder and Thornton. There seems no limits to the resources and efficiency experts, fishing mammals navigate their way around the world. Consider the desert ant. After meandering hundreds of meters from its nest, the ant manages to scuttle from home in one straight line in unfamiliar ground. Honeybees use an internal clock and sensitivity to polarize light to remember the location of food, communicating to the hives through their famous wackle dance, although that's not thought to be correct now. And there are the Arctic tern, taking a round trip from the North Atlantic to Antarctica of more than 70,000 kilometers. And the world is a round trip, yeah. David Barry's incredible journeys is a brimful of wayfinding wonders, but it is a valuable for what it reveals about our ignorance. No one knows how these terns stay on course across vast expanses of open oceans, or how juvenile European cuckoos find their way to the wintering grounds in Africa for the first time without guiding parents. Pigeons are known to have a keen sense of smell, but despite decades of research, we can't agree if they use it to navigate. The consensus, and it's interesting, there's a little group of person who just trained their pigeons to fly at night. He did a lot of flying at night, and then he just won all the pigeon things. Now, the other thing is that People often give, the big truck arrives and they load up with crates of hundreds of pigeons, and it goes up and they get a text that the pigeons have been released, and then they'd be celebrated if 5 return. It's pretty amazing. Okay, the consensus is that animals can sense Earth's magnetic field, but now how they use it remains unclear. There are 3 radically different theories, any or all of which may prove to be correct, right, Barry, adding, some entirely different mechanisms may be at work. Many biologists have spent their lives wrestling with the mysteries, and their obsessive ponderings and genius experiments are fascinating as behaviours. Take Rutgers Werner's one of the greatest authorities on navigational abilities of ants. He made his breakthrough discovery that they aren't using an inbuilt sun compass by painting over parts of their tiny compound eyes and watching their response. Mathis wasn't intent on finding how ants calculate distance, had the idea of attaching miniature stilts on some subjects and shortening the legs of others to see if they affected the length of their journeys. He found that stilted ants overshot the nest, while amputees pulled up short, thus confirming his idea they were counting steps. It's bloody amazing. Wow. All of this was enough to make everyone with the vaguest interest in science want to grab a magnifying glass and head to the desert. Thanks to the likes of Wilner, Whitaker and Carl von Fuchs, who deciphered the honeybee waggle dance, we now know a lot more about animals get around and their acute sensitivity to the surroundings. Barry's passion makes him an engaging guide, flitting from fact to anecdote like a butterfly hunting for nectar. Oh, beautiful. He also uses he is no less animated about the skills of early humans who explored most of our planet and colonized much of it without the help of tools apart from the finely tuned senses and native wits. In the age of GPS, it's easy to forget that modern humans possess the same sense of wits, though we use them less and less. How our brains form cognitive maps that allow us to remember routes and places is mysterious and always remarkable, as the migration of the Arctic turned to the dead reckoning of the dead ant. That's amazing. Let's hope that by the time spatial neuroscience has revealed more about the wayfinding faculties, we still know how to use them. Isn't that beautiful? Don't dismiss. AI more than human is spread across several levels of London's Barbican Centre, 16th of May, bringing artists and scientists together to ask big questions about machines, our minds and ourselves. I think this upcoming events in Britain. Great thing, really used for us down here. Okay, this is interesting. This is about games. Games column. While time-travelling tourists, one of the great accidental extras of a well-researched game like Assassin's Creed is a sense of historical time place they create. Some even let us play translating ancient hieroglyphs. Oh, that's interesting. It makes me think about the integrated Blue Mountains project. I was approaching the Parthenon in Athens when I saw the awesome sight. It stopped me in the tracks. Standing before me was a gigantic statue of the goddess Athena, glittering in splendor and towered over 3 stories overhead. Hang on a minute, I thought. Is that really meant to be there? Yes, it turns out, but only because I was standing in Athens at 400 BC, as painstakingly recreated in Athens in Assassin's Creed. Athena's Procomus sculpture, long since destroyed, was one of the wonders of its time, a perfect attraction for the time-travelling tourism offered by Assassin's Creed series. The draw of these popular games, of which there are now a lot, is a sense of time and place. I have explored Renaissance Italy, Victorian London, and ancient Egypt. In each game, I find myself putting aside the story just to wander around taking in the sights. This ability to explore your leisure, some unique in video games as a medium. A film Gladiator may bring the Colosseum of ancient Rome to life, but you only get to look where the director Ridley Scott wants you to. By contrast, Assassin's Creed Brotherhood gives you the run of the entire city at the turn of the 16th century. Of course, you could simply read a book or let your imagination run wild, but actually, navigating a space brings a whole new perspective. It sounds silly, but part of the appeal of Assassin's Creed for me is realizing that the history has history, as shown in the crumpled Colosseum in the Brotherhood, which by the time had been ancient for centuries. Not content with ambling around early Greece, I've also been trying my hand at fictional archaeology in Heaven's Vault by a small UK developer called Intel. The 3D world game has far less sophisticated than Assassin's Creed, but when combined with the 2D animated characters, this gives a whole feeling of charming lo-fi feel. You play as Alia Astra, a researcher at the University of Iox, and you attempt to decipher the lost language written in cryptic holographs. The game involves travelling around the nebula, a collection of moons joined by the rivers of oxygen, hydrogen and ice, gathering inscriptions and attempting to translate them. The translation effort starts off at a pure guesswork. In an early example, you're presented with two words, the first of which could be friendly or holy, while the second might mean beloved emperor. From there, you can make sense of some reasonable inferences, perhaps that an extra squiggle will transform emperor into empress, or maybe the short hieroglyphs between the other two means am, and you build translations upon translations. Your choices determine how the plot of the game unfolds. It's incredibly satisfying to see a word that you translated in one context cropped up in another, reaffirming your choice. Equally, it's frustrating when you realise a word cannot possibly fit, potentially undoing a whole chain of translations. Though, thankfully, the game lets you go back and change your mind at any point. While I've never spent any time attempting to crack a real-life ancient language, I imagine experts encounter similar bouts of success and failure. Heaven's Vault might get you an archaeological PhD, but it's well worth your time. 41 minutes in. Let's see what the time is. It's 5 to midday. So, Finding Our Voice by David Robson. The origin of language is one of the biggest mysteries of human evolution, but it looks like we've finally cracked it. In the beginning was the word, and the word was what? At least since biblical times, we have polls of the origin of language. Oh, gee. I've just got to remember people, you know, I've just got to go back and remember what I've done. There's the bees, the ants navigating. I think we did not just do that. And then there's games. So I just need a bit of time. So there's the games, bees find their ways. Miss the picture. Then there's all the letters. So what's what's artificial intelligence? Modern languages, the Yama people. Oh yeah, they could. There's whole heaps of things besides DNA. How the votes worked, stuff like that. So I'm just going back to see if I can remember all of it. There's warning against high tech cities. Ice melting. I can't believe I read all this. And tech giants, how the tech giants might be broken up. It's so hard to remember, memorize all this. okay. Even among hundreds of primate species, not one has a communication system that comes close in its flexibility, infinite range of expression. Without language, our greatest achievements, including almost everything we see around you, would be impossible. Unfortunately, this chapter of our story is written in invisible ink. The archaeological record can only offer circumstantial evidence to the language until writing began a few thousand years ago. This has led some argue that the search for language origin is pointless. In 1866, the Paris Linguistic Society even banned discussions of the subject, a prejudice that continued amongst scientists for nearly 100 years. Fortunately, modern evolutionary theorists are less deterred in the work that combines findings of archaeology, anthropology, cognitive science, and linguistics that we are finally beginning to track down when we and why we found our voice. The ideas emerging could solve not just one, but two enduring mysteries about human evolution, tell us. Let us first consider the time. Given the dearth of hard evidence, some researchers have claimed language arrived rapidly 40,000 years ago. When there was creative explosion in cave paintings, symbolic culture demonstrating the abstract thinking language requires. This explanation was never wholly convincing, however. Humans have already been migrating into dispersed separate groups by this point, so it would have had required simultaneous cognitive shift in all populations around the globe. That's brilliant. Sure enough, accumulating evidence of evolution and key anatomical changes has made it capable of speech. Little doubt that language must have far deeper roots. For a start, the great apes have a large air sacs in their throat. These help them make booming calls to scale rival, but inhibit the production of distant vowels and sounds crucial for human speech, according to the acoustic simulation of Bart de Boer and the Free University of Brussels in Belgium. Our earliest ancestors had such air sacs, but they aren't found in the Homo heidelbergus, a common ancestor of Neanderthals and modern humans, and evolved 700,000 years ago. Both Neanderthals and modern humans share a range of number of nerve pathways for the brain through the spine to the diaphragm and muscles between the ribs. These provide defined breath control necessary for precise vocalization. In addition, both species have characteristic changes as part of the inner ear, giving greater sensitivity to sound frequencies within the range of the human voice, an essential adaptation for allowing subtle changes in utterance to convey different meanings. Then there's the FOXP2 gene, which influences the brain's wiring, plasticity, and area of controlling speech. It's widespread in mammals, but we carry a version that enables us to make finely controlled movements of our face and that's required for coherent speech. Neanderthals share similar versions of the gene, which suggests they too were capable of complex articulation. Given these converging findings, De Boer and others are now convinced that speech sometime emerged at 400,000 years ago when human Neanderthals diverged. It may have even started hundreds of thousands of years before that, they argue, when the ancestors first began displaying more sophisticated cooperative behavior, possibly 2 million years ago or more, when stone tools were imply people were hunting. Language and speech arise from a complex mix of physical, social, and cultural influences that evolved in a piecemeal fashion, says Dan Dew of the University of Lyon, France. Quote, so we are bound to find degrees of language and speech going back to Homo erectus, Stephen Lesson, Max Planck Institute of Psycholinguistic in Neanderthals agrees. Homo erectus hunting and tool-making abilities indicate some kind of advanced communication systems, he said. Singing and signing. Establishing what pushed us along the evolutionary path has been harder. Most ideas fall into one of three camps. Charles Darwin provided the first and the most provocative. In The Descent of Man, he argued that human ancestors passed through a kind of musical proto language, like bird songs. The calls had no specific meaning, but were used by males to attract mates. In this way, voice flexibilities first emerged through sexual selection, with competing males developing more complex songs to beat their rivals. Only later, as humans' intelligence grew, did the sounds slowly become associated with certain meanings. You can see him studying birds and all things like that. Darwin pointed out another group of primates, gibbons, sing to attract their mates. The modern science offers some hints of an intimate connection between language and music in humans. Brain scans, for instance, reveal that they are processed by overlapping neural networks. But evidence that language and music emerge through sexual selection is weak, since you would expect to see large sex differences in the ability of the result. There are other possibilities, however. Perhaps the driving force wasn't male display, but an equal duet between mates, or even singing by parents to calm their babies. Nevertheless, many researchers don't buy these arguments. Indeed, some propose a gestural proto-language in which the first language was communication arose by hand movements, and this is one of the things you get in the army. They've got all these army things that attack. That's attack, gun group, scout, rifles. Yeah, okay. Similarly, the spontaneous emergence of sign language among groups of hearing speech impaired people indicates an instinct to use our hands when our voices fail us. Lefferson is a fan of this theory, noting Homo erectus, besides lacking the anatomical changes needed in later species, would have used gestures to coordinate hunting activities. Non-human primates can be surprisingly dexterous with their hands, and some, in captivity, have been taught to communicate using complex signs, but tend to find it harder. Oh, God. to learn to reproduce specific sounds. Gestures may therefore have been much easier means of communicating ideas at the beginning of the language. What would have prepared our brains for some challenges of language such as, this is the entire thing, beautiful, you, when you're creeping up, sign language is going to, science can just flush through your unit. It's quite amazing thing to feel. What would have prepared our brains for some of the challenges of language such as capacity to connect symbols with meanings without making huge amounts of the primitive voice boxes? As compelling as the arguments are, the gestural part of language can't really explain why we made the switch from primarily vocalized language. That question brings us to the third idea, the notion that language first emerged through onomatopoeia, the imitating the sounds of things. It is perhaps the most intuitive of the three possibilities. After all, even children will merely neigh and howl, say, to signify a horse or wolf. Yet historically, this option would have been had been the underdog, thanks to the couple of seemingly insurmountable issues. First, it requires the talent for vocal mimicry. Yet, our early ancestors lacked the anatomic neural adaptation needed for control vocalization. However, it is now emerging that non-human primates have more breath control and vocal flexibility than we thought. Some orangutans can learn to whistle, for instance, and reproduce sounds to a certain pitch. This suggests our early ancestors may have been capable of crude imitations without too many anatomical changes. Oh, interesting. Meaningful sounds. The second objection about the onomatopoeia is too limited to form the basis of a proto-language. How were our ancestors to signal silent concepts such as a particular plant or tool, or something more abstract like directions to a river? What would they use to represent a quiet animal like a rabbit? Hand sounds, by contrast, could outline the shape of something and means of movement, and another augment for the idea of gesture to hamper with speech. But recent research suggests mimicry is more versatile than we'd assume. Gay Lapin at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Marcus Perman at the University of Birmingham, UK, set up a competition in which participants had to convey a range of concepts such as cook, gather, knife, and fruit, using made-up vocalizations. The scientists then played recordings to a new set of participants who had to guess what the meaning. Contrary to expectation, they performed far better than chance, suggesting that more inventive onomatopoeia, such as a whooshing of a blade, to communicate a much wider range of concepts than originated. With so many pros and cons of each hypothesis of proto-language, we seem no closer to finding the answer than the Paris Linguistic Society of 1866. Both the all three ideas contain an element of truth. After all, 7,000 or so languages spoken today, including Australia's Aboriginal language and the Parnese Vanuatu, use elements of song, hand sounds, initiated sounds with and words interchangeably. I would guess the language must have always been multimodal to some degree, said Dewey, so perhaps instead of offering complete explanations, these three ideas may work together to provide a unified theory of the origin of languages. That is exactly what the anthropologist Jerome Lewis of the College of London is now proposing. Yeah, I don't know these things about. Yeah. Like Darwin, Lewis believes that singing was the first step in freeing our vocal cords in place of sexual selection. However, he suggests it emerged for protection. The idea was inspired by his work back at society in South Africa, where people take turns to sing all night to ward off predators. Their intertwining voices, singing at different pitches, make the group sound far larger and potentially more dangerous to animals surrounding. I would say so. That's a good idea. Similar behaviour has been found among sand people in southern Africa and Indian forest societies. Lewis suggests that singing became used for defence of our ancestors descended from the trees. Trees offer a very secure environment for avoiding large predators, he said. When we started to walk upright and became to savanna-like landscapes, we would have been vulnerable to a frightening array of large cat predators. The first songs would have sounded completely different from the refined music that we sound today, but chanting or chorus would still scare away animals and can help protect vulnerable groups. And this business of vocalizing and changing tones to disguise the number would have led to a short on vocal dexterity and crucial evolution for more sophisticated vocal voice boxes and speech articulates. And you can imagine that if you couldn't sing, the worst thing, you get eaten by the lion. I think that's brilliant. Lions taught us to teach by eating people who couldn't speak. This, in turn, would have enabled a growing talent of mimicry, which may have aided hunting. Modern hunter-gatherers often imitate sounds of forest animals to draw their prey towards them, says Lewis. They also use vocalizations of such bird noises to locate different groups of members in the forest as they coordinate movement. Employing mimicry in hunting would have given our ancestors such immediate evolutionary advantage. It would have established the idea that a voice sound can represent something meaningful. People who have used, and I think sort of, it's like if you could do mimicry, that would be, you know, you're a bored woman, and you've got someone who is a good mimic, you might say, oh, come on, you're okay. It would have also established the idea that a voice sound can represent something meaningful. People who have used, would then use the same sounds during storytelling in a mum performance and perhaps to teach novices how to hunt. Reenactments play a crucial role in transmitting the sort of knowledge you require for collective hunting, says Lewis. This, in his view, was tipping point. Once pantomimed communication arose, the sounds and gestures could quickly become more structured and stylized, eventually establishing agreed lexicon between speakers and resembled a modern language. There is substantial evidence to back this last development. Various external experiments have asked participants to use gestures and improvised vocalizations to communicate ideas to successive groups. As this gets passed from person to person, they become more systematic and possess that appears to make it more efficient and easy for the new piece of kit to learn. Likewise, in communities where people who are hearing and speech impaired haven't been taught or recognized sign language, their DIY signaling lacks formal grammatical structures. However, over just a couple of generations, more standardized rules emerge. Bonding exercise. Let's see, we're at 56 minutes. Bonding exercise. Lewis's general idea has been well received by other researchers. I think musical proto-language, in tandem with iconic gestures and iconic vocalizations, compelling theory, says Perlman. Robin Devlin of the University of Oxford also embraces the idea that music helps language evolve. The breath control required for singing is crucial for language production, he says. Language post-date wordless singing and probably by quite a long way. He also backs Lewis's proposal that the first songs helped ancestors avoid predators, but with a twist. Singing together, he points out, simulates production of endorphins, hormones, and promotes social cohesion. So it would have allowed our ancestors to live in large and large groups, giving them a strength in numbers. Singing evolved to bond groups because the bonded group keeps predators at bay. Lewis, for his part, agrees that group bonding was an important function of those early musical vocalization. In his view, he also helped create a shared trust that is essential for all languages to take off. Suddenly you get the feeling of us, he says. Words, after all, would be useless unless more people are using them and honestly and cooperatively for shared interests of the groups. If correct, this unified theory solves two of the biggest mysteries of human evolution, the origin of language and singing. It would also be another testament to Darwin's genius. Although he argued speech was originated via musical proto-language, he also described how gesture and onomatopoeia could have adapted to attach meaning to our utterance. Words may not fossilize, but hundreds of thousands of years later, after language emerged, we may finally be able to find to be right their story. Thanks for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.